Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not every day we get to do this, believe you me, but today on the broadcast, monetary policy and bourbon.
The punch in that punch bowl is still 108 proof.
A chat with the president of the Dallas Fed from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 16 July. Great to have you with us, everybody. Deals, 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 people. That is the business vibe this afternoon. The bourbon and monetary policy thing comes a little bit later on. Sorry about that. We are going to start with Rupert Murdoch and his continuing efforts to take over the world, the media world anyway. Murdoch already owns cable networks like Fox News, the broadcast network that brings us Family Guy and The Simpsons, and the movie studio that produced Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which is supposed to be pretty good if you haven't seen it. Today, we learned without really needing the confirmation that he wants more. Murdoch's 21st Century Fox made an $80 billion offer to buy Time Warner, itself the owner of cable networks and a movie studio and a whole bunch more. So Marketplace's Dan Weissman gets us going.
Time Warner has finally shrunk itself to the exact right size and shape for someone like Rupert Murdoch to be interested in it. Jim Goss is with Barrington Research.
Time Warner used to have AOL as part of its portfolio. That's no longer true. It obviously had Time Inc., the magazine publishing group, but as of about a month ago, that's no longer true as well.
Most importantly, Comcast's proposed takeover of Time Warner Cable creates a huge potential adversary on the other side of the bargaining table. Distribution. That's Murdoch's adversary, too. Porter Bibb runs MediaTek Capital Partners. He thinks a merger will help Fox.
Fox with Time Warner would have an incontestable leverage against any distributor in terms of the audience demands. People would go berserk if they couldn't get what Fox would own.
Think Game of Thrones and sports. Turner Broadcasting has a lot of NBA games. Here's another piece of conventional wisdom. This is the beginning of a long campaign. Murdoch has spent years pursuing deals that are important to him.
He likes to win. I think he'll persist.
That's Samuel Craig from NYU's Stern School of Business. He says Murdoch may find allies on the other side of the table.
I think when the shareholders of Time Warner look at it, particularly if the price goes up a bit, they may say, this is a pretty good deal and we should do it.
Which leaves one more question. How much will my cable bill go up if all this goes through? In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
Deal number two on the hit parade today is Apple and IBM. The pair, once rivals in the PC market, say they are going to collaborate on software and cloud services, and IBM will get to distribute Apple products to some of its biggest customers, big businesses, schools and universities, and the government. Apple gets to get more of its devices into the office. Interestingly enough, though, some of the key companies in this deal are not the companies actually in the deal. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
Norman Young, an analyst with Morningstar, says this deal may have caught BlackBerry and Microsoft and, to some extent, Google by surprise.
They didn't really think that Apple would really compete in this space because they never really had.
For a long time, Apple's focus has been on consumers. But according to Stacy Crook with the market research company IDC, Apple has been making inroads. We've seen more of what she calls BYOD.
We just use the same device for our business use and our personal use these days.
IT guys and gals have tolerated that, sometimes grudgingly. These days when we bring our own devices, odds are they're not BlackBerries.
You know, from a BlackBerry's perspective, this is pretty significant.
That's tech analyst Sharon Cross. She says BlackBerry made its name selling its devices to big business, and the security of its network was a huge selling point. With this new partnership, Apple and IBM say they'll give big business the assurance their apps and devices will be just as secure. So what about Microsoft?
This agreement is good for Apple, it's good for IBM, it's bad for BlackBerry, and it's really not that impactful to Microsoft.
Because, Cross says, companies will still buy PCs running Windows. IBM could have partnered with Google. After all, Android phones remain popular. But Roger Kay, the head of Endpoint Technologies, says Apple's trademark simplicity may have given it an edge.
IT managers don't have to deal with a hugely complex environment. They know kind of what they're getting.
There are hundreds of different types of phones and tablets that run the Android operating system. With Apple, there's just a handful. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
This item from the Economics of Geopolitics file before we go on. Late this afternoon, the White House announced new Crimea and Ukraine-related sanctions, and it's more than just travel restrictions on a bunch of Russian oligarchs. A couple of really big oil and energy companies, state-owned Rosneft and Gazprom's financial division, Gazprom Bank, have been cut out of U.S. medium and long-term debt markets. That is to say, no loans beyond 90 days. That Murdoch offer for Time Warner, boy, did it goose Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Fed Chair Janet Yellen was back on Capitol Hill today, saying pretty much the same thing she was saying yesterday on Capitol Hill. That was the Senate yesterday. Today was the House. The economy's getting better, she said. Still not good enough. Labor market slack. Nothing too surprising. But Dr. Yellen was not the only member of the Federal Open Market Committee making public remarks today. The president of the Dallas Fed, Richard Fisher is his name. He was in town, by which I mean this town, by the way, L.A., for a speech over at USC. We asked him to swing by for a chat, and he did. Mr. Fisher, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
This is an interesting speech in a whole lot of ways, but the takeaway from it is that you have some issues with the way things are going in monetary policy in this country. You're not pleased.
Well, it's not that I'm not pleased. I think our team does an awfully good job. I just think we have to be careful not to fight the last war.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, we had a horrible downturn, as you know. We had a crisis. I think the Federal Reserve did a superb job in keeping us, under Ben Bernanke's leadership, from sliding into depression and deflation. And one of the things that Ben Bernanke left as his legacy as chair was a 2% intermediate-term target for inflation, just so we could have a sense of what we would work around. Sometimes we'd undershoot, sometimes overshoot. We're getting
and your point is we're worried about it going down,
yeah. But now we see these – I see these pressures rising, and we're beginning to see a little bit of wage pressure, interestingly enough, and some shortages in key areas, everything from truck drivers to engineers to IT people. And that's usually an indicator that eventually you're going to have – more general inflation.
And you think, and you say this in here, that we have been too loose for too long and that the Federal Open Market Committee, on which you sit as a voting member,
yes, sir,
needs to seriously start thinking about pulling the Fed farther out of the economy and maybe getting that federal funds rate started going again.
Kai, we have in our family a duck hunting property. We own wetlands in East Texas and spent a lot of time duck hunting. So when you
I should interrupt here and read the title of this speech. Monetary Policy in the Maginot Line, with reference to Jonathan Swift, Neil Irwin, Shakespeare's Portia, Duck Hunting, The Virtues of Nuisance, and Paul Volcker. It is, I will tell you, an entertaining speech. But please go on.
Well, here's the point about duck hunting.
Yep.
Those that do duck hunt aim ahead of the bird in their flight pattern. They don't aim where the bird is currently. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that monetary policy operates with a lag. We need to aim ahead of the flight pattern. And the flight pattern right now is an economy that is improving more quickly than we expected.
Yep.
It's not robust yet. It's not something to get super excited about. But it's happening faster than we collectively expected. And we also see a little bit of price pressure. Again, nothing to worry about, but it's increasing. So my point is that we should consider just tweaking a little bit the amount of accommodation we provided. We have been doing that. We've been cutting it. We were buying $85 billion a month.
Right. So the taper is in place. And
we're going to I think we will end up reducing that taper to zero in October. We're on that path.
Pulling
now.
Back from the bond buying program is,
yes,
is what
we,
that
when
is.
We buy something, we pay for it, and that puts money out in the system. We've been putting a lot. And our balance sheet as a bank, we were at $900 billion before the crisis. We're now at $4.5
trillion. Trillion,
yes. This is a lot of money. A lot of it's been put back to us in terms of banks just parking their money on the 12 Federal Reserve banks on our balance sheets. And that's a big number, over $2.5 trillion. That means it's not being lent to people because there's not enough demand to borrow it, or there are disincentives from borrowing, and that comes from the fiscal authorities.
So all the money that's out there is not getting through the economy.
That's my point. It is flowing into the speculative markets, the stock, the bond, the other commodities, and all other things that trade. So we've had a very rich market, as you know, and you report on so well.
Well, I'll tell you what. Thank you for that compliment. About the speculative markets and stocks and all of that stuff, we had Neil Irwin from the New York Times on the program about a week or two ago about his article that you cite in this speech saying this is the bubble of everything.
Yeah.
Neil said, and you don't disagree in this speech, that part of that, no small part of that, is the Federal Reserve's fault for plowing all this money out there and letting it sit there.
Well, the word fault is tough, but let me just walk you through the cause here. If you feel that a powerful central bank, and we are the largest and most powerful in the world, and other central banks have followed suit, if you feel that we're going to basically guarantee you against the downside risk, then you're going to take more risk. And money does burn a hole. I don't know about you, Kai, but it burns a hole in anybody's pocket.
You,
so
it does that, but you use a better phrase here. You actually, and the fraternity listeners out there will appreciate this, you call it beer goggles. The Fed has given investors beer goggles.
Well, things do look a little bit more better when you have a lot of liquidity in your system, right?
I told you it was an entertaining speech.
I just think the markets look awfully good. We've provided a lot of liquidity, and other central banks as well. So it changes the whole way you look at risk.
The question has to be asked then, since you are a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee this year, and you say this in the speech, you have not cast a dissenting vote.
Not in this go-around. I wanted to see the taper occur, and it's occurring.
So
I wasn't in favor of the program, but I lost that argument, and I'm happy that we're tapering it down to zero.
Are you going to, the next time you gather around that big table at the Fed building, are you going to dissent and
I would never answer that question, Kai.
Well,
I mean, it really is an issue of I did lay out what I believe should happen after I think we will stop tapering in October. So we're no longer adding to our portfolio. But as I say in the speech, the punch in that punch bowl is still 108 proof. 108, by the way, is
Jack Daniels, by the way. Yes.
Well, it's actually Wild Turkey.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
And,
Wild Turkey.
My former chairman at the Dallas Fed, the founder of Southwest Airlines, I think it's the largest consumer of Wild Turkey bourbon in the world. So he's taught me a lot about Wild Turkey. But the point is, I think we can start diluting that 108 proof by not reinvesting the proceeds. When something matures that we own now, we just put it back. We buy something equivalent.
Right.
So I think that'd be a gentle way to signal to the markets. The economy is improving, assuming it continues to improve, and I think it will. And that would be a good bridge to then eventually, when we decide as a group to raise rates, it won't shock the markets as much.
Your use of the phrase, a gentle way to warn the markets, how much do you guys, as you are, and Dr. Yellen as well, and the women on the FOMC, how much do you think about how closely the markets are watching you, if that makes any sense at all?
Well, we have learned through the crisis, maintaining financial stability is important. And our previous chairman, two iterations ago, Mr. Greenspan, had more of a laissez-faire Ayn Rand approach to regulation. We changed that under Chairman Bernanke. And again, we're tightening those screws under Chairman Yellen, Chairwoman Yellen.
I think just chair is what she prefers.
We call her chair.
Yeah. Well, you call her Janet.
I call her yes, ma'am.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
So but at some point, as the economy improves, which is the good news, the real economy, real people go to jobs, not just the rich and the quick, then we have to taper back the amount of stimulus we provided the economy. And, you know, maybe even someday, Kai, our fiscal authorities, meaning the Congress and President might get their act together as well.
Thank you for the segue, because the last thing I wanted to touch on is this idea of how much more difficult your job is made by the absolute inability of political Washington to do anything.
Well, I think it's an enormous burden to rely entirely on the central bank. We provide the fuel. We provide the gasoline for the motor of the economy. Someone has to incentivize people to step on the gas pedal and move the car forward. So I hope our fiscal authorities will somehow get their act together. That's dreaming, of course.
I was going to say,
Republicans
hopeful?
And Democrats and whoever's in the White House, and will say, how can we incent people to use all this abundant money the central bank has provided to put the American people back to work?
Richard Fisher is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. It is, as I said, a good speech. We'll have a link to it on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much for coming
to the
studio. Coming up,
we are now being followed by at least two cars full of big men.
That was Rob Schmitz, but the story is this. When Chinese consumers start complaining about pollution, what do you suppose happens? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 77 points today, 0.4%, closed at 17,138. The NASDAQ popped up 9 points, 0.25%, ended things at 4425. The S&P 500 nudged up 8 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1981. Merger talk lifted the markets today, as I said. That 21st Century Fox bid for Time Warner
Oh, my. Juice the cable company, 17%. Not a cable company, actually. It's just a straight company, 17%. Fox, on the other hand, slunk down 6%. News of a partnership between Apple and IBM gave Big Blue a boost. IBM blinked up 2%. Apple ducked about a half of 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a Senate subcommittee on consumer protection, product safety, and insurance holds a hearing on examining accountability and corporate culture in wake of the GM recalls. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for June. And 30 years ago, the minimum legal drinking age in the U.S. was set at 21. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. California is, as you know, a couple of years into the worst drought it's had in a generation or so. This is, for the record, the third driest year out here in the past century. So, California officials have decided to get serious. $500 a day fines for overwatering or having a hose without a nozzle or hosing your driveway off, not sweeping it. Annoying, perhaps, for homeowners. But things were a whole lot worse for California farmers, as Dan Bobkoff reports.
California's drought is costing its agriculture industry $2.2 billion this year, according to UC Davis's Center for Watershed Sciences. Josue Medellin is a researcher.
There will be some pockets of deprivation, poverty.
400 square miles of farmland has been fallowed, mostly lower-value crops like alfalfa. Bruce Blodgett heads the San Joaquin Farm Bureau and says that has real ripple effects on employment.
It takes people to, even insure those crops. It takes people to truck those crops to market.
But the impact could be far worse. The reason is farmers in the Central Valley have managed to find another source for 75% of the water they normally get from state and federal reservoirs. They're drilling deep into underground aquifers, pumping out enough water to cover 7,800 square miles, a foot deep.
I'm fortunate enough to have a well for groundwater, but it's caused our electric rates to probably triple.
Thomas Olm's farm in Modesto is getting only half the reservoir water it's usually allocated, so he's relying on his own well to keep his almonds, walnuts, and grapes growing. He says his neighbor just drilled a well, too. All this drilling and pumping is unregulated, and
eventually, of course, you run out of water.
Robert Glennon is the author of Unquenchable, a book about what he calls America's water crisis. He says think of California's groundwater like a giant milkshake glass.
And what California is allowing is a limitless number of straws in the glass. Well, that's a recipe for disaster. It's utterly unsustainable.
And he says, we don't know if this drought will last another year or another 50. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Added to the list of things that the Great Recession changed about the American economy is this. The size of American homes, that is their square footage, which had been expanding for decades, actually dropped a bit the past 5 years. That, of course, prompted speculation that perhaps we were finally done with the McMansion, that we'd be building smaller and smarter. That, of course, proved to be wrong. Tracy Samuelson reports on some new census data that shows newly built homes are expanding once again.
There's the media room, the playroom, the formal living room, the formal dining room. American houses just keep getting bigger. A typical new single-family home built in the U.S. last year was 2,400 square feet, slightly bigger than the pre-recession highs of 2007. Robert Dietz is an economist with the National Association of Home Builders. He says it's all about who's able to buy these days.
So the typical buyer, the average buyer, is typically older. It's typically a move-up buyer, someone who has more income, more wealth. And someone like that is more likely to buy a larger home.
Mark Goldman teaches real estate finance at San Diego State University.
I would call it the return of the McMansion.
He says builders like to go bigger, too, because they get higher margins.
It's adding space by itself without adding more bathrooms or a significantly more expensive kitchen. The cost for that next 100 square feet of space isn't that much more.
The question now, says Stan Humphries with the real estate website Zillow, is whether millennials will continue America's 80-year trend of building bigger. Right now, they prefer surprisingly small rentals, but that could change when they go to buy.
You may love having your 250 square foot place where you store your sweaters and your jeans in the dishwasher. But once you're married and have kids, that arrangement looks entirely different.
That big house in the suburbs starts to look pretty good. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
G20 China has, as you've heard here and elsewhere, a brutal problem with air pollution, not unlike we did 50 years ago. The world's second biggest economy, that would be them, also has the fastest growing consumer class on the planet, not unlike we did 50 years ago. So today for our series, We Used to Be China, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz finds out what happens when millions of new consumers get angry about the state of their environment. Call it, not in my backyard, Chinese style.
Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan province, is home to a thriving tea house culture. But there's more than tea brewing here. The tradition of chatting away the day with friends has for centuries made it easier for folks here to gossip and talk about politics and current events. Lately, the talk has been about air pollution.
There are more people and more cars and more industry. The pollution is bad for all of us. We all have lungs. The government needs to do something about it.
But Wu Youchang, who drinks tea with her family, isn't hopeful. In the past year, one of the most notorious projects in the history of China's oil industry began operation outside the city. It's a $6 billion petrochemical plant run by China's largest oil company.
The people here didn't want the plant built, but they built it anyway. It's going to harm everyone's health. It's something people should protest.
The people of Chengdu tried. Last year, many here among the city's 14 million residents planned a weekend public demonstration to protest the plant. When the local government found out, police detained organizers, sent out text messages warning people to stay inside, and the government required people to work on the Saturday of the protest, forcing high school and university students to remain in class through the weekend. Officials are still paranoid. Within minutes of arriving in Chengdu, I call a source who had agreed to talk with me about how the pollution affects her family. She abruptly cancels our interview. She's being interrogated by police officers who had intercepted our emails and text messages. The next day, I hire a driver to take me to Pengzhou, the site of the petrochemical plant, a refinery that's as large as the city. In a small village in the plant's shadow, I stop to talk to a farmer.
My home was destroyed for the plant last August. The sky here is always polluted now. The plant has had a huge impact on our health.
Before I can get her name, a man pulls up beside me on a motorcycle and asks me what I'm doing. He glares at the woman. She dashes off. I tell him I'm a journalist and I'm talking to people about pollution. There's no pollution here, he says. Before I can ask him his name, he makes a call in his cell phone. A minute later, a group of thugs show up.
Wow.
I hop in the car and we drive to another location and begin talking with people, but the men catch up to us and continue the intimidation campaign.
We are now being followed by at least two cars full of big men who are driving very close to us and now taking pictures of our license plate through their window. And now they're more or less chasing us out of town.
Back safely in Chengdu, I speak with Jin Lei and Guo Xiaohong, a husband and wife who are concerned about the plant.
A lot of people are concerned about the plant, but people are no longer willing to do anything about it. They don't think they can change the situation.
Jean and Guo's two daughters are playing in their living room. A couple of years ago, when the pollution in Chengdu was particularly bad, the couple had to bring both girls to the ER several times for breathing problems.
The pollution that year was just as bad as Beijing's. I used to train for triathlons, but I've stopped that because my bronchitis was so bad.
Back in 2005, when Jean and Guo were studying at elite schools in Beijing, they were among a group of students permitted to attend a talk by Al Gore. He was visiting Beijing to talk about his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. After the talk, officials allowed only one question from students. Jean raised his hand, and Gore called on him.
I asked Mr. Gore, what can we as normal people do to help China's environment? He said, you are the representatives of China's young generation, and you must have faith that things can change. If you don't have faith, then future generations will have less faith.
Jean and Guo have now applied this message to how they live in Chengdu. The couple uses reclaimed water to help grow their urban garden, and they've taught their daughters to use bathwater to help flush the toilet.
Whatever mandate the government hands down that will help protect our environment, we will support it 100%. As a country, we must work together. Otherwise, we'll all pay the price.
We must have faith, he says, echoing what Al Gore told him, that things can change. But sometimes in China, it's hard to keep that faith. Just 2 hours after I leave Jean and Guo's home, the police show up to intimidate them, too. In Chengdu, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on We Used to Be China, we go back to the days of acid rain. You remember that? And I'll tell you what, if you haven't already, send us pictures of your city's air, would you? Your blue sky, your gray sky, whatever you got. You can post them at Instagram with the hashtag MarketplaceSmogCheck.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which we saw on Bloomberg today, apparently, and this kind of does stand to reason when you think about it, the use of profanity by CEOs varies with economic conditions. Bloomberg actually went through and did a word search of earnings call transcripts for the past 10 years. Profanity peaked in 2010. It dipped a bit, shot up again in 2012, and has been declining ever since. I know. You want to know what the words are, but I can't tell you that because I really need my job. Although I do have a rule that says you can say anything you want on the radio one time. We've got the chart on our website that will give you the details. All right, we are done. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow up 70 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ popped up 14 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 nudged up 7 points. That is also a third of 1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.